Right now, I'd like to introduce Michael Marriott. He's the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Michael, thanks for being here tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you back on the show. It's been a while, and certainly no shortage of issues to discuss, and we're glad you're here tonight. Tell our listeners just a bit about your group, NIRS, N-I-R-S, Nuclear Information and Resource Service.
Sure. We're basically, for lack of a better word, I guess, the Washington office for the very decentralized grassroots movement for a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future. We monitor the federal agencies, the Congress, and all the different reactor sites out there and get the information from all these places and get it out to all the people across the country and help them understand it and help them use it.
Well said. And Michael, I thought of the many issues we wanted to touch on tonight, the first one we could talk about is the flooding on the Missouri River here in the United States. We've got two nuclear power plants on the river, one in very grave danger, the Fort Calhoun nuclear plant in Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. And then I guess I'm not sure if it's upriver or downriver, but you've got the Cooper nuclear station, which is south of Omaha, again, on the flooded Missouri River. And I think most of us are aware that in Fukushima, the tsunamis knocked out the auxiliary power, the diesel generators that were needed to power the cooling systems of these nuclear reactors. When they failed, of course, we had the resulting meltdowns of several of those nuclear power plants in Fukushima. Could you just give us a general update on the situation on the Missouri River with these two nuclear plants?
Sure. One thing to remember is that the tsunami came very fast. There was no time for anybody to do anything about it or take any protective measures. The Missouri River flooding has been coming very slow. It's been coming for weeks. Everybody's known it's been coming, and it's going to be going on for weeks more. So it's a very different kind of event in that the utilities involved have had a lot of time to prepare for it, and they have to be able to withstand something that's going to be taking place for a much longer duration. And they did take a lot of steps to deal with this. Unfortunately, over the weekend, they had some setbacks. Let me say first, Fort Calhoun is just a few miles north of Omaha. It's about 5 miles north of the Omaha suburbs, about 20 miles north of downtown. Fort Calhoun is about 80 miles south of Omaha. And Fort Calhoun is the bigger problem right now. It's basically an island right now, in the middle of the Missouri River, and it's not supposed to be. The only access to the site is by boat. All the roads have been cut off. And they had installed an 8-foot water-filled rubber berm around some of the vital buildings at the site. And over the weekend, workers doing something else at the site accidentally punctured the berm. The water came out, and some of the electrical switch yards flooded. About 2 feet of water came in, and they had to cut off the off-site power for about 12 hours. They were running on their emergency diesel generators while they pumped the water out that had seeped in. And, you know, whenever you have to run these emergency diesel generators, that's you know, some reason for concern, because they don't always start up and they don't always run for as long as you might want them to run, so it's best not to have to test them out. Fortunately, they did run for the 12 hours, and hopefully they won't be needed again. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes you nervous about this particular plant, because this plant has been, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, one of the three bottom-performing reactors in the United States for the last couple of years. And, in fact, if this flood had occurred 6 months ago, this plant almost certainly would have been inundated in a scenario that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says would have been a 100% chance of a meltdown. They weren't prepared for a flood like this, And the only reason that they're coping with it now is because the NRC forced them to, over the last several months, to beef up their flood defenses. So while everything is okay right now, there's been no radiation releases, no actual accident at the plant, there is some valid reason for concern as we watch these waters continue to rise, and we watch this utility, which just has not seemingly been very competent over the last few years to handle, like I said earlier, an event that's going to be of quite long duration and a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong. We're expecting these floodwaters to be high through August.
So it's an interesting thing you say there about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission forcing the plant operators there in Missouri to beef up their flood protection. It seemed to have worked. We don't hear enough stories about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission being so proactive. Was it the Fukushima plant disaster that motivated them to go into action here?
No, this had actually happened last year, last summer, I believe, where the NRC realized that this plant is part of a larger investigation of this plant. Like I said, it's been considered a problematic plant for a while, and where they realized that the flood defenses, the plans for dealing with the flood at that site just weren't adequate. And yeah, it's true. You don't hear that much about the NRC. I mean, more normally you hear the kind of stories that we've been hearing this week about the NRC reducing regulation, not enforcing regulation, doing everything they can to keep a lot of these aging reactors operating in spite of safety deficiencies. This is one of those rare cases where the NRC did take action, and so far it's proven effective. So we applaud them for that, but we wish they would do that more often.
Exactly. Michael Marriott is our guest, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And Michael, if there's not anything more that would be useful to hear about the situation on the Missouri River with these two nuclear plants, maybe we can move on to get an update from you on the nuclear disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plants struck by the earthquake-generated tsunami on March 11th, and I think our listeners are quite familiar with the story there, but maybe you could give a summary update for us.
Well, you know, it's amazing how quickly stories like this drop out of the newspapers and TV news. by reading those, you'd think nothing had ever happened. But, in fact, things are still happening at Fukushima. Radiation continues to be released on a daily, hourly basis. The reactors are continued to be overheating. I mean, not at meltdown level kind of overheating, but they continue to release radioactive steam. They've got an enormous problem with just thousands of tons of radioactive water that have accumulated underneath the reactor vessels, in trenches, in other buildings, and they have to continue putting new water into these reactors to keep them cool. Because even now, more than 100 days after the accident, if they don't keep putting water on these molten cores to keep them cool, they will overheat again and begin melting again. So it's just an enormous problem as to what to do with all this water. They've been trying over the last 2 weeks to set up what they're calling a water recirculation system, where they're trying to take this highly contaminated water, clean it. They run it through various types of filters. One filters out oil and contaminants like that, and then another one actually filters out is supposed to capture a lot of the radioactive materials, especially the radioactive cesium, and then another desalinizes it because a lot of it was originally salt water. And once it's gone through all these filters, and the idea is they run it through the system and then try to use it to actually help keep the reactors cool so they don't have to use so much water from outside. But they've been having just terrible problems with it. The first time they tried it, the radioactive filter section in 5 hours received as much radiation or trapped as much radiation as they thought it was going to do in 5 weeks, and the filters couldn't operate anymore. They had to shut it down. And just today, they put out a press release saying, well, they'd finally gotten everything fixed, and it was turned on and it was working, and then an hour later it shut down again. And we haven't heard yet as to whether they've gotten it back working again. So it's just this, you know, mammoth job still going on there. The situation remains very unstable and really quite dangerous, because these reactor buildings, especially units 3 and 4, are in quite bad shape. They're continuing to receive aftershock earthquakes there, and there's just a lot of concern that a large enough aftershock could cause the collapse of the buildings, which would be a disaster. There's concern that they're not going to treat this water in time, and eventually it's going to overflow and get back into the Pacific Ocean. As you might remember, there were some large releases into the Pacific Ocean earlier in the accident, and you know, what we're talking about now is much more contaminated water and very close to overflowing. So it's an ongoing situation, and it's not going to end for quite a while. Their current goal, and their goal has changed a few times already, but their current goal is to get the site in cold shutdown, which basically means, you know, stable and relatively safe by next April.
Wow, that's a long time. That is an amazing series of events, of course, that I think most Americans don't know enough detail about, in consideration of the attempts made to revive the nuclear power industry in this country. But, Michael, when these... and you can be more specific than I can, but when these nuclear power plants melted down, there were reports that some of them, at least one of them, had melted through its containment vessel on the bottom, hence the word or the terminology China syndrome. This thing potentially could just keep burning itself down into the earth until it hits a water source, and then would send up this enormous vent of steam, you know, really spreading more radioactivity around. What is the ultimate solution to this mass of melted fuel rods that are on the bottom or burned through some of these containment vessels of these nuclear plants at Fukushima? What can they do to reverse this horrendous situation with the meltdown?
Well, you know, right now... You're right. The fuel, in fact, we believe, not that anybody's been able to actually get down there and take a look, because it's much too radioactive for that, but the belief is now that, in fact, the fuel melted through all three of the reactor containments that had fuel in them. Unit 4 did not have any fuel in it, and so it didn't melt down, but it had problems with its fuel pool. But the other three, yeah, it's believed that they did, in fact, breach the containment. And for the most part, the fuel is sitting either at the bottom of the reactor pressure vessels or where it's leaked out underneath them in pools of water. And that's where the water continues to boil, because the temperature remains above the boiling point, and where they have to continue putting more water in to replace the water that's boiled off and has leaked off. Now, you know, the temperatures aren't anywhere near the point where the fuel itself would begin melting again. That's a several thousand degree level, and we're talking about right now levels slightly above the boiling point, so slightly above 212 degrees, and running, I don't know, 230, 240 or so right now. But the problem is, if the water did all boil off, even now, the decay heat would then begin to rise again. Now, at some point, the decay heat, and in fact, you know, this is already happening, the decay heat would rise much more slowly than it did at the beginning of the accident, where the fuel began melting within hours of the earthquake. It would take much longer now to get to a high temperature. And at some point, again, it will get to, you know, assuming that there's no more enormous problems, it will get to a point where the decay heat is not enough on its own to heat up like that. That's the goal. Now, what they're going to do with this mess over the long term is anybody's guess. Various firms, various engineers that have looked at the problem, at least a cursory look. I mean, nobody, since you can't go there, you can't actually see what's going on, nobody's really positive what kind of shape everything's in, but the estimates are it will take anywhere from 10 on the low end to perhaps 30 years to be able to clean this mess up.
10 to 30 years. Wow. So nuclear power is for keeps.
And, of course, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes. Wow. Well, Michael, I wanted to move on before we run out of time. There's a lot to talk about here with the nuclear disasters and potential disasters, but summarize for us, if you would, the most important aspects of the Associated Press investigative series by Jeff Don and his team that really I think was very useful in understanding better what the shortcuts have been taken by the nuclear industry itself and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to be overseeing that industry, in terms of potentially very dangerous things going on at the U.S. nuclear power plants.
Well, the first thing of interest, I think, is that they documented something that actually we found ourselves not long ago as well, which is that radioactive tritium has leaked at three-quarters of the U.S. nuclear sites. It's leaked into local groundwater, it's leaked off-site in many places, and it's leaked at levels far higher than are allowable in drinking water. Now, there isn't, at this point, evidence that this is actually leaked into drinking water, but the tritium is very mobile, and if it gets into groundwater and things, it can move very quickly. So it's concerning, and what should be especially concerning, of course, is the, you know, industry's constant refrain that of nuclear safety and that they don't have leaks and that kind of thing. Well, in fact, three-quarters of the nation's nuclear sites have experienced these leaks over the last decade or so. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and this is something that, you know, those of us who work closely in this business are also pretty aware of, is that, you know, as the U.S. reactor fleet ages, and the average reactor in the U.S. Right now is more than 20 years old. A lot of them are more than 30 years old. A few of them are right around 40 years old. As they get older, just like any other, you know, piece of machinery, any other large, complicated mechanical thing you can think of, they age and they experience more problems. And this is particularly true in a reactor where you not only have sort of the normal kinds of aging that you might find in a, you know, a car or, you know, or a factory or anything else, but these these are operating in environments of extremely high heat and extremely high radiation. So, and that causes different effects on materials than would be the case under a non-nuclear environment. And so the NRC has, you know, what the AP found is a pattern of the NRC giving exemptions from regulations to utilities to allow them to not have to spend a lot of money to keep these reactors running, relaxing regulations to make them easier to meet for utilities, and generally sort of bending over backwards to keep these reactors running at a cost that the utilities are willing to pay. Now, if the utilities were willing to, you know, pay any cost, that would be one thing. But for the utilities, these older reactors are basically cash cows. These old reactors, they're the ones that have been actually paid for. The construction, the initial construction costs have been paid for, and now, you know, they just want to run them flat out and make as much money as they can until they can't run anymore. And the NRC has been, you know, really bending over backwards to allow that to happen. And in the wake of Fukushima in particular, which were also, you know, sort of older reactors and poorly designed reactors, it's really time that the NRC step up and take a close look at what they've been doing. And if they won't do it, it's time for Congress to step up and take a close look at what the NRC has been doing.
What do you feel Congress should be doing right now in terms of investigating the charges in this Associated Press investigative piece? What do they need to do?
Well, three senators, Senator Boxer of California, Whitehouse of Rhode Island, and Sanders of Vermont, actually have already called for a congressional investigation of these charges. And Senator Boxer herself is actually in the best position to do that. She's chair of the Senate Environment Committee, which has jurisdiction over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And if she's calling for an investigation, well, she ought to go ahead and get it going, and I suspect probably she will. And I think what they need to do, you know, from our perspective, is to not only, you know, bring in the commissioners and talk to them, and, you know, the commissioners are the ones appointed by the president and who set the policy, but I think they need to bring in some of the high-level staff people as well, who are career people. There's a major, you know, revolving door between the NRC and the nuclear industry, as you might expect. It's not unusual in government. And they need to bring these kinds of people in and find out exactly why. You know, look at some of these specific instances. For example, fire protection. Why nearly some 30 years after, or actually more than that, 35 years after a major fire at the Browns Ferry reactor in Alabama caused the NRC to write rules to protect reactors from fires, why most of the reactors in the United States still don't meet those rules. And, you know, it's basically a national scandal that they don't. We've been pushing and pushing and pushing for 20 years ourselves to get them to, you know, take this seriously. And the NRC just constantly gives exemptions in amendments and allows these reactors to operate even though they don't meet the fire protection rules. And I'll just give you a very concrete example so you can get an idea of what we're talking about. The rules say that the wiring from the control room to the safety systems, you know, everything's electric, so you need these wires, that these wires should be protected by fire barriers, by inflammable, by, you know, material that can't catch fire, so that in the event that you do have a fire, you're still going to, the wires aren't going to burn, and you're going to be able to control the reactor. Well, all these years later, a lot of plants still don't have these barriers in place, and as a substitute, the NRC allows what they call fire watches, which is a guy who walks around the plant and looks for fire. And if he doesn't see a fire, he keeps on walking around the plant. And they do this, you know, every couple of hours, 24 hours a day. And that's the fire protection program. And that's just not acceptable.
Michael, we only have about a minute left, but I did want to, well, I should just mention, this is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM. We're speaking with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And as we wind up, Michael, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of the revolving door between the nuclear power industry and the folks in government who are supposed to oversee that industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, do you have an idea of what structure could be put in place and as an alternative to the status quo right now to get rid of that kind of a collusion and coziness that's not all that healthy in terms of oversight?
Well, you know, it's almost impossible, really, because if you are in the nuclear business, there's one of two places you can work, either the NRC or the nuclear industry. I mean, it's really... you really don't have a lot of choices, but I think what particularly Congress may want to take a look at is less the staff people and more the high-end people like the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners, because for one quick example, former Commissioner Jeffrey Merrifield was a commissioner of the NRC. He voted on numerous issues affecting the nuclear industry and affecting particular companies in the nuclear industry, and as soon as he left the commission job, in fact, if I remember right, he even resigned early to go take this job, he took a job at a major nuclear contracting company that's one of the leaders in wanting to build new reactors. And that kind of thing could be stopped by, you know, prohibiting NRC commissioners from working for companies that they vote, you know, that had issues that they voted on while they were at the NRC, for example. I mean, there might be some way to set something like that up, because you know, these are the guys that set the policy, and they're the ones that make becomes really questionable when they go work for companies that they helped while they were on the commission.
Indeed, conflicts of interest certainly. Stink to high heaven in some of these arrangements. Very dangerous, too, as you've been talking about. Michael Marriott, thanks for being here with us tonight. And leave our listeners with your web address so they can get more information about NIRS.
Well, we're at www.nirs.org. And we do have a page up there that we're updating pretty close to daily on the floods in Nebraska. You can join our email alert list there. And find out a lot of information there.
All right. Well, thanks for making time for this interview tonight, Michael, and we'll be checking in again soon. Thanks for being here with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Michael Marriott, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and their website is nirs.org.